Brave New World.
Hello and welcome to Brave New World programme. My name is John Harrison. The view of Russia from Washington has never been exactly crystal clear. The steppes and forests of Russia are a long way from the banks of the Potomac River, both geographically and in terms of mindsets. And right now, it seems anything Russia or Russian is scapegoated and quite simply detested. In this program, I talk to Don Kavalik, who teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and has just written a new book called The Plot to Control the World, about this growing impasse that has come to characterize U.S.-Russian relations, and ask him if the U.S. has adopted a sort of collective tunnel vision. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Now, the U.S. and Russia, I mean, they haven't always been at odds, have they? I mean, there was a time when the U.S. and Russia actually got on quite well together. For example, during the American Civil War, when the Russian-American relations were actually pretty good, pretty cooperative. And, I mean, of course, the Second World War with the Russia-Great Britain alliance with the Soviet Union. And when did U.S.-Russia relations really begin to sour in the 20th century?
Well, certainly after the Russian Revolution of 1917, mm-hmm. you know, the U.S. immediately opposed the revolution. Well, first of all, the U.S. supported, you know, the Tsar even before the revolution. After the revolution, as you know, the U.S. and a number of other capitalist countries invaded Russia on behalf of the white counter-revolutionaries, and the U.S. passed the Alien Sedition Act of 1917 to try to go after radicals in the U.S. who they saw as sympathetic to the Russian Revolution. So while it is true the U.S. and the Soviet Union had an alliance against the Nazis in World War II, I think from the U.S.'s point of view, certainly that was a marriage of convenience, which as soon as the war was over, they were content to break. And so I really do think since 1917, it's been a relationship fraught with tension. I think the only period in which there was any, you know, real, you know, good relations was probably during the Yeltsin years.
Yeah.
But that was because Yeltsin was more or less a vassal of the United States.
Yeah. And we're talking about, I reckon, what, 5 or 6 years, really, aren't we, from about, you know, beginning of 1991 to the elections in 1996, when Yeltsin almost lost power, lost to the communists, and the price that he had to pay, I think, to retain power was such that already the whole alliance with the US in terms of NATO and everything was already being questioned by a faction of Yeltsin's party. And so relations began to sour pretty quickly, didn't they, after that?
Yes. And then again, you know, there's some ups and downs. When Putin first is elected, the US said, oh, Putin must be a good guy because he was, you know, picked by Yeltsin, who was was a good guy for us. And so for some time we got along with Putin. You might remember that, of course, George W. Bush said he looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul and saw him as a friend. And of course, Putin and Russia helped with, you know, after 9/11, Putin was the first world leader to offer the condolences. He actually did help in Afghanistan with the effort there after 9/11. But then again, relations soured again. There's a few reasons for that. I think when Putin did not go along with the U.S. invasion in Iraq in 2003 was a big turning point for Bush. I think as far as Obama was concerned, who also tried to reset relations with Medvedev, things really went south with the U.S. and NATO invasion of Libya, which from Putin's point of view was a betrayal of what he thought his country had at least given the Security Council a mandate by abstaining from the resolution for a no-fly zone over Libya. No, and it's been very tense ever since then, and that's when, of course, Putin decides to get involved in Syria, and then things really take a very bad turn at that point.
Yeah, and of course we have the whole episode of the expansion of NATO in Eastern Europe, and another 13 countries that have suddenly adopted into the fold, and Russia's absolute disappointment, and what do they do now, you know? But the question I have for you really is more to do with the present, in that we have the situation where Russia, it seems to me, and being not in America, and I hardly ever go there, you know, but from a distance, it does seem as though Russia is being used as a sort of football, you know, to clout the Republicans by the Democrats. And it seems to be Russia's present role. Very useful, I should imagine.
Well, yes. And of course, you know, it was a very useful role during the Cold War as well. I mean, as Eric Hobsbawm, the great historian, pointed out once, you know, the antipathy of Americans towards Russia is in our DNA. And it's very easy to trigger that animosity towards Russia, and it's being used for both political purposes, particularly by the Democrats, but also for, you know, reasons of, you know, the military-industrial complex. You know, they always need an enemy. Mm-hmm. To justify the scandalous amount of money the U.S. spends on the military. And Russia is always a good scapegoat for that and a justification for that.
Yeah, I spoke to somebody here, actually, the man in charge of the Carnegie Center here in Moscow a couple of days ago, and he just commented that, in a way, Russia is kind of cheap. It's regarded as, you know, that the Russian economy is almost insignificant, I think, to the American economy. And therefore, America feels that they can do what they'd like with Russia. And when somebody's cheap, you can mistreat them and abuse them quite easily, at least more easily than you could if they were very strong. And this point that you made about this anti-Russian sentiment being part of the DNA, you know, American DNA, that's a very strong statement. And I guess my question is, will this just go on forever? Because Russia does play the part so well, doesn't it, in American eyes?
I think it's hard to see an end to it. Yeah. I think from the Russians' point of view, from Putin's point of view, I sincerely believe they wanted a thawing of relations. You know, Putin has called the U.S. a partner, even after all this conflict. I think they are very frustrated. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia truly wanted and believed it would be accepted into the West.
Yeah.
Which is where I think they dream of being, you know, and it never happened.
Yeah.
And I don't think it will happen.
Yeah.
And maybe for the world, it's, you know, and for the Russians, maybe that's not a bad thing. You know, I think there needs to be a counterweight to U.S. hegemony. And, you know, interestingly, the U.S. has kind of forced that role upon Russia time and again, whether they wanted it or not.
Okay, let's take a short break here and carry on this very interesting conversation just in a minute or two. Don't go away.
Brave New World.
Welcome back to Brave New World program. Today I'm talking to Dan Kovalik, who teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, about this whole US-Russian scenario, which seems to have got way out of control. So Dan, we were talking about the sort of the history of US-Russian relations, recent history, and we touched on the present situation now. Now, a lot of historians in Russia are now saying that the real problem with Russia, as far as America goes, is not Russian aggression, because actually it seems though that Russia's the aggressor, but it's not really very aggressive in comparison to some other players.
Exactly.
I hope you agree. And it's certainly less
with the US.
It's certainly less aggressive than than the Soviet Union was under communism. I mean, you could compare communism as being number two as compared to liberalism in terms of foreign policy, you know, when you actually get annoyed if other countries don't believe in the same things as you do. I mean, what could be more aggressive than that? So I mean, these Russian historians are arguing that that's not the problem. The real problem is that Russia did not want to accept U.S. leadership in the late 1990s and has been upset ever since. I suppose because of this liberal foreign policy. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, I have maybe just a slightly different take on it.
Yep.
I agree with Stephen F. Cohen, who said, you know, essentially the problem the U.S. has with Russia is that the bear has gotten back on its feet. It simply does not want any country, any power in the world to present any ability to rival the United States anywhere. And that's why it doesn't like China either.
Yeah.
That's why it doesn't like Iran in the Middle East. The U.S. believes it should be the only world power, and it resents any country that aspires to have its own role like that in the world.
Yeah. Now, listening to you, you know, you put things very clearly, very concisely, and in political terms. But I'm wondering that if beyond all this isn't really the problem in culture, that American culture somehow allows for this feeling of superiority, this assumption of superiority, and that other countries should actually go along with it. Because I know that we're listening to politicians, the politicians are coming up with this stuff, but I keep on reminding myself that somebody who votes for the politicians, you know, that's the people. Is there something in American culture, popular culture, which allows for American politicians to act in this way?
Yes, well, and there is a word for it, and it goes by various terms, but manifest destiny is one way to put it, and the other one is American exceptionalism. Mm. You know, America was founded, the current America, as opposed to that which was, you know, found by Columbus. Obviously, there were already people there, and there's a culture already there. But our country, as it is today, was founded on the notion that God ordained us to have a country from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Those who brought that about felt justified in murdering and sacking every people who got in the way.
Right.
And that sort of manifest destiny carried over to once we got to the Pacific to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, to go to Hawaii, to go to Alaska, to go to Puerto Rico, to go to the Philippines, you know, where we went and slaughtered potentially millions at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And on and on. If there's anything even more in our DNA than the resentment towards the Russians, it is this belief that somehow America has a right to rule the world.
Yeah.
And that is a very dangerous philosophy, but it is a very powerful one.
Yeah, I think it's just frightening. And I see the appearance and the strength of the God right in America, and the millions of people who really do believe that, you know, if they don't behave themselves, they might not go to heaven, you know. And this is really real, you know. And I don't mean to offend any Christian listeners, please, who are listening to this program, but nevertheless, when religion mixes itself up with politics, you do tend to get extremism, don't you? And I mean, I'm very frightened by this.
Well, and you should be. And again, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I think there's a very positive strand to Christianity, the Christianity of Jesus on the cross and Jesus the defender of the poor. But somehow, the strain adopted by people in the U.S., they take Jesus off the cross and now make him a conqueror somehow. It's Jesus with the sword.
And it's
heretical. And but it is the belief, and it is dangerous to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And I think you hit it right on the head. It is a bad religion, and but it is very powerful.
Yep. Okay, last question, Dan. Now, many say that the days of American global domination seem to be coming to an end, perhaps because America keeps on shooting itself in the foot in terms of foreign policy, and respect for America is cracking, you know, all over the world. And I mean, but America is still, you could say, the most powerful country. There seems to be a transition period going on from America being the most powerful country and the dominating global force to America, just, if that isn't enough, being the world's most powerful country. At the same time, we see Russia moving further and further away from its imperial dreams. I mean, Russia is not even trying to pretend that it can summon up the unity of the ex-Soviet republics. You know, my question would be, in the future, could we see these two powerful countries actually finding common ground, in a way, sort of post-imperial common ground?
I certainly would hope so. I certainly think it's within the, you know, realm of possibility. I think the danger right now is that the U.S., as you're suggesting, is a wounded animal. It, you know, it is this fierce, strong beast. But its power is waning, as you say. Mm. But the fear I have is that it will only cause it to lash out even further. Mm-hmm. At least for the foreseeable short term. And as you say, it is shooting itself in the foot. Look at all these sanctions the U.S. is imposing.
Absolutely.
Throughout the world. What's happening is the countries are running away from the U.S. dollar. They don't want to be subject to possible sanctions. We're sanctioning ourselves out of the world economy, and there will be a crash. I mean, that will hurt a lot of people. Mm. But I think it is not sustainable the way the U.S. is progressing.
I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much indeed, Dan Kovalik, teacher of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and a author, just actually come out with a new book called The Plot to Control the World. Highly recommended. Everybody about U.S.-Russia relations and more. Thank you very much indeed, Dan, for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, listeners. I hope you found this program interesting. Please tune in again next week. Goodbye.